We welcome back to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Good day to you, Mr. Fleming.
Oh, if only, sir. How's it going?
We're doing pretty well here. Looking forward to talking about some, well, I guess we would say some underappreciated musical talents.
Yes, I think I sent you a big list of underappreciated sonic pioneers, is what I call them, I think. And they are the people who have been the architects of a lot of popular musical sound over the decades, whom you might not necessarily know about, even if you've listened to the music that they have factored in making.
Well, let's start with Herschel Evans, a tenor saxophonist who worked with some of the biggest names in jazz.
Yes, he did. His really big association, though, is with Count Basie, and he died very young. A lot of people in jazz, of course, the star-crossed, and have died at just horrifically young ages, and Herschel Evans was 29 when he died, and normally you would die in jazz. It would often be because of narcotics and whatnot, but he had heart disease. So you can go in your 20s, I guess, of a bad heart. And he was part of a dream tenor saxophone lineup, I guess you'd say, with Lester Young. And they had very oppositional styles. Lester Young's style was very vaporous, very aerated, breathy, a lot of space between the notes that he played. And Herschel Evans was this stomping, bluesy blower of a tenor saxophone player. And they had this sparring rivalry. They didn't get along very well, but they made great music together. They're almost kind of like Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth. They weren't bosom buddies, but obviously they featured really well back-to-back in the Yankees lineup. And finally, Lester Young just got sick of listening to Herschel Evans talk about how great he was. And he said to Herschel Evans, he said, "Some of you guys are all belly," meaning that he had it going on mentally, and he was lobbing the charge that Evans was more of just a physical player. But he was a great player, and he died really young, in his 20s, like we said. And one of the pioneers of tenor saxophone, one of the first people that I think would return to and say, "Oh, he made me want to play. He made me approach my horn a given way." And he had a huge influence on the decades of players that came.
Well, another guy had a huge influence, at Johnny Johnson, who worked so very closely with Chuck Berry. Even before, and we talked about Chuck earlier with you, coming to rock and roll really from a blues approach to things, and a lot of that was largely due to the piano work of Johnny Johnson.
It's an apt segue going from the Count Basie band, Basie was the pianist, to Johnny Johnson, Chuck Berry's pianist, and he was a lot more than Chuck Berry's pianist. Because I think, like you said, that Chuck Berry wasn't an overt, not that it existed at the time, but looking back retroactively now, he wasn't an overt rock and roller. He was more of a T-Bone Walker, jump blues, Count Basie swing type of musician. Count Basie, if you listen to those early records, those Decasides, they're very driving. They're very Chuck Berry-esque, and I'm sure he listened to loads of them when he was fashioning his sound. Part of his sound, every bit is integral to his sound. You'll hear it now when you go back and you hear a given Chuck Berry song, Johnny Be Good, or whatever it may be. Listen to the roll, because you think it's all about the guitar and those guitar breaks and the lick at the beginning and the riff that goes throughout the song. Listen to the roll the piano plays. Each Chuck Berry number, many of them at least, they're like these piano concertos. And the piano is going the entire time. Almost like in a way that Keith Moon would go with The Who when they were doing Tommy and everything. He's just going. He's having this concerto on his own. Keith Richards opined that Chuck Berry actually based his guitar riff on Johnny Johnson's piano. So he is, again, talking about that idea of the architecture of somebody's sound. Well, there you have this surface from which Chuck Berry built up so much, and is this virtuoso, rollicking boogie-woogie elements of piano playing, and very Basie-esque, interestingly, although Johnny Johnson had more technical skill than Basie, but again, he's underpinning all of Chuck Berry's music.
Let's talk about Earl Palmer, a great drummer, part of that New Orleans sound, who worked with guys like Fats Domino, Dave Bartholomew, and then a very key part of backing up Little Richard on his early hits.
Yeah, he worked with Sam Cooke, too, because he was someone that you'd bring in when the person who was there in the studio couldn't quite get down what the band was trying to do. So he was all hands on deck as a percussion player. And those Little Richard songs, they're largely driven by Palmer's drumming. And it's funny, when you listen to Little Richard, you hear that he hadn't quite figured out, and again, like this kind of volume was so unprecedented, but he hadn't really figured out the dynamics of the microphone. That's why you'll hear so much distortion at the ragged edge of Little Richard's vocal sound. But you have Earl Palmer, he's always right in the pocket. He's always driving the beat. And again, it's that notion of being virtuosic, but he's a phenomenal timekeeper. So you could ask him to keep that necessary beat. And this is beat music. And the Beatles wanted to be beat musicians. And that's where they got the beat in their pun-based name. And so you had to drive the band that way. And again, it's coming out of that dance tradition, same tradition as Basie, but it's more frenetic. It's this atomicized version of what had been happening before via a stop at gospel music. And Palmer was the perfect person to encapsulate all of these things and really be the kind of locomotive engine of Little Richard's sound. So Little Richard's on top. He's doing the upper portion of that music where he can do all of his falsetto, all of that. But you can't do all of that without the bedrock, without the foundation.
Next up, a guy that I didn't know much about, but you schooled me some on the work of Hubert Sumlin as a guitarist with Howlin' Wolf.
Yes, a crucial architect, sonic architect. He was the backbone of the Wolf's formidable sound, and he was a guitarist who was in love with a kind of scuzziness, I would say, distortion to the point of making you think something was wrong with your record player or your speakers. And the Wolf himself was, as befitting his name, quite down and dirty and feral. You always get the feeling that he had just rolled in some mud before he came in and did his vocals and whatnot. And Sumlin was the perfect guy, perfect acolyte and perfect partner for the Wolf. In his guitar texture, it's he doesn't really do like a lot of riffs. It's very fill-based, and the solos are jagged. They're angular. You almost hear a Hubert Sumlin element and aspects of post-punk, weirdly enough, because it was very punk in its way for its day. And it sounds so now. It sounds almost like barnyard punk, where you're walking past the barn on the farm and you think, what on earth is that noise, that electric noise coming from in there next to the car that's propped up and everything? And there would be these guys just going to town. And to me, his tone really just comes from that place of, oh my goodness, what's going on in there? I need to check that out. It's futuristic, and yet it's as old as the dust at the same time. So quite a blend.
And another guy that I wasn't really familiar with, but was a key player with Miles Davis and many others, Tony Williams.
Yeah, he came on the scene in Miles Davis's band, and he had been playing on a lot of Blue Note sessions, and Blue Note was the label in the late 50s, especially in the early 1960s, where you had that hard bop, that hard soul type of element. Jimmy Smith, Hank Mobley, whom we've recently discussed, and Tony Williams would play on records that were a little less mainstream, that approached a kind of chamber music, really, a jazz chamber music. Now, it's not free jazz. It's not atonal. We're not going out into Don Cherry land, anything like that, or Ornette Coleman, Albert Eiler. He wouldn't play on dates like that. But you'd hear him with a group like Miles Davis' second great quintet. And that's when Davis was really stretching out by letting his musicians stretch out. Now, Tony Williams is 17 at the time he joins this band. This is one of the all-time great small ensembles in any musical medium. And Miles Davis said, it all begins with Tony Williams. He freed me. He freed me as a trumpet player. He freed me to think about what I'm doing with these other guys. He freed me as a writer. Because a drummer can be a great asset like that. You don't think of music being written for the drum, like Mozart would write, given works for like the horn player or something like that. And musicians write for guitarists, and they certainly write for singers. But I think Miles Davis, with that second great quintet, would actually write for his drumming prodigy. He was, in essence, a prodigy as a teenager. He also died young, but I would say that he's many jazz drummers' idea of what rock people like to think of John Bonham as.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. And lastly, well, another guy who died very young, only 23 years old, bassist with the Duke Ellington band, Jimmy Blanton.
He is the best player here out of all of these formidable players we are talking about. He might be the greatest player in the 20th century on his respective instrument. He might be better on the bass than Jimi Hendrix was on guitar or whatnot. It's like, you know how when you look at baseball, you see like war and the second baseman's war.
Yeah.
Jacked. Like Joe Morgan, right? And you think, like, well, you hit like 271 and you had 78 RBI. But it's the position you play, so maybe you don't get as much credit and numbers are freighted a certain way to fit your position. Jimmy Blanton was that for the bass, because we don't think of the bass as necessarily a very sexy instrument. But he shows up in Duke Ellington's band. And Duke Ellington just got the most fabulous players that you could have. That was like making the BSO, except it was jazz, and you toured around the country playing dances. And he gets Jimmy Blanton. He only has him for a short period of time because he's failed by tuberculosis. But it freed him. It freed him even more than Tony Williams freed Miles Davis. Duke Ellington is deep into his career. He's revered. And he realizes in this virtuoso that he can write in ways. And they would duet together too, piano and bass. And it sounds, when they duet, like it's not a duet. It sounds like there are 24 voices. Like when you get all that studio technology, like when the Beatles had Sgt. Pepper, all of a sudden they didn't have four tracks. They had 64 tracks to work with or whatever it was. And so you had this going on, but organically, not through studio trickery, because this guy playing the bass always sounded like 15 guys playing the bass. No one had ever used the bass as a lead instrument in jazz, and it became the lead instrument of the Duke Ellington unit.
With many of these musicians, Colin, it seems to be a common theme, and maybe it's because they come, so many of them, from the jazz world, but that ability to sort of know what the leader of the band is looking for and be a step ahead of them or right in sync with what they want to do.
It's a highly connective form of music, of interplay. And I think that is what drives people, the best musicians, to jazz, because what you're doing is you're writing on the spot. Now, you call it extemporizing, but it's a form of live composition. And so the best rock and roll bands, like we mentioned The Who, if you hear them on a recording from 1969 or 1970, it's a very jazz-based sensibility. And you have the Tony Williams figure in Keith Moon. You have the Jimmy Blanton figure in John Entwistle. And you get the same kind of thing with Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce and Cream. And they had a very pronounced jazz background. But it's that idea of you cannot fake being that good. You're going to go, it's like going out there and skating on the first line at the Bruins game tonight. Like, I'm going to be exposed. I won't be able to pull that off. I'll look good, like, before the puck drops. It's like, oh, no, get this guy out of here. And I think that's part of the appeal and part of the challenge and part of the prevailing freshness, perpetual freshness of jazz. And it crosses over into rock, but you don't get it with classical music because you don't want to tell a classical musician to improvise anything. That goes against their entire nature. They'll get up, they'll leave. That's not for them. So really, it's the richness of jazz, I feel.
Well, and that's why I think of you as a jazz man in the writing world, because you're able to improvise but go in any direction. And we see it when you come on the show with us that, you know, you've got some people and you need to stay in one fairly narrow lane. With you, I know we can go anywhere and we're going to get a great, insightful analysis and discussion. And it's the same with your writing. You write in so many different genres, so many different styles that it is, to me, it is like a great jazz musician, but with words.
But it's like you said, when I'm writing a story, or even just talking to you like right now, certain things present themselves, and they take you in a given direction. And then if you're confident in yourself, and you're confident in the characters, you're confident in the ideas, you're going to get informed of the next steps to take through those ideas, through those characters. They're going to take you so long as you can sit back and be in that groove and let that happen. Because people would ask me when I first came on your show, they thought that we scripted all of this.
Right.
And that I was reading something to you. Like, we worked really hard. Like, we were up late at night the night before saying, oh, man, Jimbo, I want to go to bed. You're like, we're not done writing. And that's just how it is. And I think that's what makes for great storytelling, that makes for great information sharing, it makes for great radio. I've never been someone who wants to be along that line of like, that kind of wasted space. You can't do that if you're on the bandstand with Duke Ellington. And you, sir, are my Ellington, and I am your Blanton. And I feel like dying today, but I've already made it past 23, so bonus.
There we go. Good news for all of us, indeed, that you're still alive and kicking with lots more to come, we hope. Colin Fleming, check out his website and all his terrific work at ColinFlemingLit.com. And Colin, we will talk with you again next Tuesday.
Okay, I'll see you later.
Colin Fleming, every week on Downtown.